Well, hello everybody. Today I'd like to welcome Dr. Kenneth Rutherford to the show. Ken is a professor of political science at James Madison University. He has published 5 books, including America's Buried History, Landmines in the Civil War, which we'll be discussing today. He was an agricultural extension agent as a Peace Corps volunteer in Mauritania, conducted refugee food and shelter operations for UN High Commissioner for Refugees in Senegal, was credit union training officer in Kenya and Somalia, and is a recipient of a U.S. State Department Fulbright Fellowship to Jordan, where he was appointed to the faculty of the University of Jordan. He is included among the 100 most influential people in armed violence reduction by the London-based organization Action on Armed Violence. He holds a PhD in government from Georgetown University and a BA and MBA degrees from the University of Colorado, where he was inducted into its Hall for Distinguished Alumni. Well, wow, that's a lot. Okay, let's welcome Ken to the show. Ken, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's great to see you, man.
Outstanding. Great to be here. Can't wait.
Yeah, me too. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. I've got your book here, America's Buried History, Landmines in the Civil War. And I've got to tell you, it's a really fascinating read. You know, I talk a lot about technology with my Civil War class, and the kids really, you know, they're technologically minded, right? We were talking earlier about this, and they really embrace the idea of the development of technology, and they're super fascinated with this kind of stuff. And I'm, you know, really looking forward to talking to you about the development of these and the use of these and the legacy of landmines in American military and elsewhere. But before I get into things with you, this is really a personal topic for you. And I was wondering if you could just kind of give us the story, just a little background of the story of what brought you to this topic.
Man, I could go on all night. I just keep it short, but I was on a road in Somalia. I was a humanitarian aid worker in the early 1990s during Operation Provide Hope. A lot of people know about Black Hawk Down, but I was injured 10 weeks after that on December 16th when my vehicle, my Toyota Land Cruiser, hit a landmine, right front tire. And the strange thing is, about a couple of weeks before was the first time I ever heard the word landmine used in a personal way, where I saw a blown up vehicle on the road. I was like, what the hell happened there? Mm-hmm. And my Somali team said I was a landmine. I was like, all right. Went back to my notes, and that was that. So we hit this mine, and I ended up losing both my legs, almost lost my life a couple times. I was in 4 hospitals in 5 countries in a matter of weeks. A lot of blood transfusions. My right foot was left in Somalia, my right leg in Kenya, my left leg in America. So that was my introduction to landmines, and sort of just wrapped up my whole international career in terms of West and East Africa with different agencies on the shelf. Got married, moved to DC. I'm a Colorado boy. Mm-hmm. We moved to DC. We had a 2-month-old, went to Georgetown. And I was just going to go on in my career. And I did for 2 decades, writing books about human security, teaching at Missouri State, JMU. I wrote some books on landmines. The origins, I thought, was World War I, when tanks were introduced in 1917. And the Germans created mines. A lot of people think it was really World War II. That they're used. I think, did I say World War I or World War II? I can't remember.
Yeah, you got them both, yeah.
Okay, good. So, that was my book in 2010. Moved to the Shenandoah Valley in 2010 to James Madison University. And about a year later, I get recruited by the local high school here to be a chaperone for our robotics team, high school robotics team, to go to VCU in Richmond.
Cool.
I don't have an engineering bone in my body. And I just said, I'll drive. I'm going to go visit some battlefields. And I did that. And I saw a way marker called Fort Johnson. It's a housing subdivision now in Henrico County that said landmines were used here in 1864. And I was like, what the hell? That photograph is in the book that you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. It shocked me. It shocked me like you would not believe. And that began an 8-year journey of research, visiting all the battlefields where landmines were used, except one. There were like 15. I did not get to Jackson, Mississippi. And riding for 3 to 4 years at 4 a.m. until about 6 before my kids woke up and the world woke up and I went to work. Mm. And so it was really a product of passion. I don't know if I wrote it for anybody in particular, but I really wrote it for the man in the mirror. Because I really wanted to figure out why the story wasn't told by really as an American who lost his legs to a landmine, possibly an American landmine. As a Civil War, I was been fascinated with the Civil War, even though I grew up in Colorado, was following this passion. And what's interesting is most of our casualties today overseas with our military are IEDs. Mm-hmm. And most of the landmines used in the American Civil War were IEDs.
Right. What a fascinating story, you know, to take something, you know, a harrowing experience like that, and then turn it into your life's work, a passion project that is really helping us understand a much bigger, you know, a much bigger story that I think many people are unfamiliar with. Like you said, you had no idea that these stretched all the way back to the Civil War. And really, I mean, until I started reading about the stuff, you know, years ago when I was started to took an interest in technology, I didn't really know all that much about it either. I know that there was a lot of technological innovations during the war, and but I wasn't really familiar with these so much, and which is why I think your book is such a great contribution to the field. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about, and one of the things that my kids noticed very quickly when I'm teaching this technology in class, is that the Confederate war effort really depended a lot on innovation. They were faced with some pretty serious disadvantages in terms of, you know, men and materiel. And so they really had limited options as to how they were going to confront that. Can you talk a little bit about the different kind of technological advancements that the Confederates undertook to sort of offset these numerical disadvantages?
Definitely. So in my research in the early years, and as you highlighted, as you know, the Southerners were very concerned about getting cotton out. And the Union had an Anaconda plan, shutting down the ports. Mm-hmm. And so the Confederacy invested, I don't know how much, but they invested time and energy into developing underwater explosives or other counter naval weapons, mm-hmm. underwater explosives with propellers, spar boats. And as the Union became more effective on these ports, 1862, 1863, the Confederacy used this technology and these inventions for the water on land. Mm-hmm. It's almost like amphibians crawling back to shore.
Right.
And in fact, I found 13 underwater Confederate mines. I didn't find them, but I was introduced to them in the basement of the West Point Military Museum. They're in the basement. It's the largest collection of underwater explosives from the Civil War in the country. Two of them were used on land. Mm. Including Battery Wagner around Richmond. And so speaking of, it's called, you know, it's innovation. You're outgunned, you're outmanned, you're desperate. You're going to grab whatever tools you have in the toolbox to use. And so one part of the story is this evolution of technology, but it's an improvised technology. Mm-hmm. It's artisanal manufacturing of explosives matched with the existing technology at the time.
And they had to try a bunch of different things, right, before they got something that worked effectively. And my knowledge of torpedoes, the ones that you were discussing, the underwater, the submersible mines that have trigger mechanisms. And when I say torpedoes, I'm not talking about the kind that you fire out of submarines, like you see in World War II films, but torpedoes that are submerged explosive devices that have trigger mechanisms on them. And you hit those triggers, and that sets the bomb off, the explosion. You can take those and bury them, you know, just under the surface, and they function essentially the same way. Isn't that, I mean, I guess, you know, they figured that out fairly quickly.
So in the book, you know, in 1861, I talk about 1860 and 1861, electronic command detonated explosives, mm-hmm. where you have a man in the loop. Mm-hmm. You have somebody pushing a button, pulling the trigger. Columbus, Kentucky, the James River. But also by like 1862, you're having contact detonated explosives,
right,
where a ship would hit an underwater mine, or a soldier would step on a mine, or a wagon would step on a mine. And so really it's the first time in the world's history where you had two different types of explosives, contact, or what we call victim activated today,
mm-hmm,
and then also command detonated or remote controlled mine. So you had both. And so it's this evolution of technology where you're bouncing back and forth. Mm-hmm. Command detonated was very effective because you could be discriminate and target what you're going to blow up. Mm-hmm. But it's also very dangerous because a union could capture those controllers. You need an electronic wire, which is very rare by 1860 and 1861 in the Confederacy. It's not really available. Mm-hmm. So contact detonated or victim activated explosives, where you and I could set a bomb outside of Richmond or outside Battery Wagner and walk away from it, we're going to be safe and fight another day. The only thing is we don't know who's going to be the victim of that explosive. So I just found it fascinating, this evolution of technology. And by 1863, this is back to your original question, by 1863, the Confederates had empowered individuals in Richmond with money, $100,000, mm-hmm, to set up a torpedo bureau. It was called the Torpedo Bureau because of exactly what you said. Back then, the term torpedo meant anything explosive related in a way. And so it was called the Confederate Torpedo Bureau, but the name was really the Conscription Bureau. It was under the Secret Service, the Confederate Secret Service. So it had code names. And President Davis would not allow these documents to be transcribed and reproduced for fear that they would fall into Union hands. And they would know, in his term, our devious devices would be known to the enemy. So, yeah. And so just back to your question too, is on the technology part. And I think one of the reasons a book like this has never been written in terms of the widespread use of landmines throughout the Confederacy, mm-hmm, all the way from Texas to Virginia and different actors, is, but there are different terms. There's a term torpedo, mm-hmm, land torpedo. The Union called them infernal devices.
Right.
Others, some of the Confederates called them subterras.
Mm-hmm.
So when you do a Google search, landmines don't come up. IEDs doesn't come up, but it's all these different various terms. And so I used a lot of primary sources, actually from a lot of Union soldiers who experienced, mm-hmm, these, because the Confederate soldiers didn't really want to say, I, Ken Rutherford, laid these landmines, because the Union would execute folks who are laying landmines, and they said that openly they would do so.
That's an interesting point, and it kind of leads me to my next question. One of the things that, you know, I was thinking about as I was reading through your book is this is really kind of unconventional warfare in a 19th century context, where men stood apart on the other side of fields from one another. There's something honorable about standing up and facing your enemy. I mean, this is, you know, not to romanticize it, but there is something about that in a 19th century context, you know, burying something in a secret way as to sort of like catch someone off guard and surprise them when they're not expecting it. If they're marching somewhere, you wouldn't expect to be under fire. You wouldn't expect to be in danger. And then suddenly your horse steps on it, you step on it, your wagon rolls over it, something along those lines. I was wondering if soldiers viewed these as an act of cowardice in some ways, or an act of malice, you know? It's kind of like the way they viewed sharpshooters, you know, in a 19th century context. A sharpshooter was somebody who hid behind something, didn't stand up and face his enemy, you know, like other soldiers would do. And I was wondering if there's something equivalent to that, you know? You said that the Union soldiers referred to them as infernal devices. Clearly, they have some sort of opinions about the use of these types of weapons. What sort of things did they say about them?
So from the Union side, from the very beginning, they called them cowards of war,
mm-hmm,
cowardly devices,
right?
Not ethical, immoral throughout the war. In the Confederacy in 1862, when landmines were used in Yorktown, and that was the first time an American was killed by a landmine or IED, was May 5th in Yorktown, when the Confederates evacuated their positions at Yorktown, moved up to Williamsburg, and they used landmines in Yorktown and Williamsburg. And General McClellan in the New York Times and other Union officers said they were shocked and horrified that that some of their West Point friends were using these weapons. General Johnston on the Confederate side also agreed with McClellan. And so did General Longstreet on the Confederate side. Said these weapons should not be used. Mm-hmm. They should be banned to the pale of civilization. Mm-hmm. And some of the Confederate soldiers who used these officers, General Rains in particular, made a strong argument why they should be used, mm-hmm. why they're illegal, and why they're ethical. And it ended up in the Confederate higher command, and Jefferson Davis and his team ruled that landmines were ethical, but their use was not unrestrained. In other words, there are constraining rules on when to use landmines to protect civilian populations, only in time of war. Mm-hmm. So that was around 1862. But as the war went on, as the war dragged on, it became increasingly common throughout the Confederacy that there was no opposition to the use of landmines or IEDs. And even General Johnston in 1863, when he was at Vicksburg, Davis was sending them General Rains, the same man that he reprimanded to use landmines at Vicksburg. General Rains never made it. He got to Jackson, Mississippi. That's why landmines were used in Jackson, Mississippi, and not Vicksburg. But there was an internal debate within the Confederate higher command that these weapons should be banned beyond the pale of civilization, or we need these, and these are legitimate tools of war, and that side won out.
It's really interesting to me that they do have that internal debate, and as you're saying these things, I'm thinking about the sort of evolution of warfare in the Civil War, where it begins as maybe a limited conflict is not quite right, but there's a shift really in terms of targets from the Union perspective. Let's say the shift in from a somewhat limited war into a much more total war the shelling of Fredericksburg, for example, or the laying waste to the Shenandoah Valley, for example, in 1864. That's a turn of events that doesn't really define the beginning of the war, but certainly by late 1863 and into the summer of 1864, it'd be much more typical to wage war on a bigger scale, including civilians. And so maybe, I don't think anybody in 1860, if you had told them that there would be a real shooting conflict, would have imagined the scale and the magnitude of what was the reality of that war by 1863 and 1864. And I guess it just stands to reason that something like landmines, especially later on, as the armies are being bled to death, especially in the Confederacy, it would stand to reason that they would resort to whatever means they had available.
Right.
It kind of makes sense. I mean, I'm not justifying the use of the weapons, but I can see where they're coming from. Yep. They use what they have. Independence was something they were pretty serious about last time I checked, anyway. Right. And so it makes sense. Would they ever, from your perspective, do you think that these were effective as psychological weapons?
That's an interesting question, because that is a very true statement, mm-hmm. that they're psychological today.
Yeah, I know. Man,
we could put a sign out in the Shenandoah Valley saying there's a minefield here. Mm-hmm. Whether or not there's a mine in there or not, no one's going to go in there.
Right.
And when you lose a limb, it's not fun. Mm-hmm. I'm speaking from personal experience.
Of course.
And the cries and the yells of the injured would have a demoralizing effect, mm-hmm. on the follow-on soldiers. And I'm just listening to what you're saying, and I'm almost surprised that landmines weren't used in more areas and widespread areas. Why were they not? One could say, well, some parts of the Confederacy didn't have extra explosives. They didn't have the manpower. The torpedo bureau was only so big. But what I also think, and you mentioned Sheridan, in the Shenandoah Valley in 1864. Earlier that year, at Yellow Tavern, when his men were injured by landmines and killed by landmines, he marched Confederate soldier POWs in front of his troops. Mm-hmm. And the landmine use stopped. Down south, on Sherman's march to the sea, His men, mostly Iowans, were injured by mines near Pooler and outside Savannah. He did the same thing. He marched Confederate prisoners of war in front. And he wrote that he wasn't surprised that his men didn't face any more landmines until they hit Fort McAllister. And in every the big problem with landmines in the modern world, and as a professor, I try to teach like what passes prologue, going back in time and now. And now we have a global landmine crisis around the world. Landmines are in 80 countries around the world, like 60 of them are at peace. Mm-hmm. But there's this deadly legacy of mines because they live for 100 years until someone steps on it. But this really wasn't the case in the Civil War. And one of the reasons I speculate is that in nearly every single case, Confederate prisoners of war were forced to clear their own landmines. And so you're going to have a very effective rate, especially if they walk over that field after you clear.
Right.
You know where they are. You have to, you know the skills, and you have to clear it. So, and then one other part of this whole story is the guerrillas, the insurgency, never used landmines. I couldn't find a single case where Mosby and others used mines. He wanted them. There's some letters in the official records of the War to Rebellion where he wanted them, but they're never delivered. Hmm. And I just think in that period of time, the effort was to protect Richmond.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. And with Mosby and his crew, I mean, they're on the move. It's, they're kind of the hit and run type, type of organization, probably putting their resources where they found them to be most important in the defense, the Petersburg-Richmond, defensive networks there make more sense to me. And now you mentioned the use of prisoners of war. That struck me as very interesting that they would go to those lengths. I mean, I know it seems silly to say that there are rules of war, but there are rules of war. And one of those things that you tend not to do is to mistreat POWs. Now, of course, we know stories that happens all the time in all kinds of different conflicts worldwide, and we've seen story after story. But the general, I believe that the consensus is that a POW is a POW and should be treated accordingly. According to those agreed upon rules. I may just be naive here.
No, you're being after World War II, mm-hmm. the Netherlands, Denmark, Norway, France, they all used German POWs to clear mines. More landmines were used in Western Europe than almost anywhere else in World War II. And you know what? Europe is almost mine-free.
Yeah.
But in the wars of North Africa, Rommel, Montgomery, Egypt is the most landmine-affected country in the world, mm-hmm. and no POWs were used there. But anyway, 4 years after the end of the war is the Geneva Conventions of 1949, which banned the use of POWs to clear up landmines, exactly what you're saying, the moral ethics of war. And so even now, if we take down ISIS or the Taliban, we cannot use those individuals to clear the mines that they laid, even though it'll save hundreds of millions of dollars, mm-hmm. it'll save thousands of lives, mm-hmm. and it'll save thousands of limbs. So just thinking of Western Europe from 1945 to 1949, and during the war, the American Civil War, when really in nearly every single case, Confederates cleared their own landmines, which explains why there wasn't really a humanitarian problem after the war.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly makes sense, but I'm wondering about the ethical concerns. At the time, did anybody at the time say, you know what, we really shouldn't be, we shouldn't be, there were marching Confederates in front of Union soldiers to, presumably trip the landmines, not necessarily to clear them out of the way, right, but to trip them. So, they'd be, I guess that's one way of getting rid of them, right, set them off, and you don't have to worry about them anymore. Were there ethical concerns during the war about this, or did it say?
Cannot find one ethical statement that this was unethical by a Union officer.
Interesting.
And even most of the Confederates, there's really no information, or they did it under protest, mm-hmm. Like at Fort McAllister, where the Confederate engineer said, we'll do it. We don't want the regular guys to do it. There's even a case where Sheridan, when some of his men were injured by mines in Yellow Tavern, some of the local civilians knew that mines were there, and Sheridan was so upset, he forced a Confederate prisoner of war to dig up those mines, put them in people's house, and set it off and blew up their house.
Oh my God.
So back here, so it's a very slippage
yeah.
of ethical rationale and reason.
And the evolution of total warfare, I suppose, waged against civilians, civilians who supported secession. So I suppose that's how they justify. Now we've talked about, and you've mentioned already World War I, in World War II, the widespread use of mines throughout that engagement. Were there debates similar to the debates they had in the Confederacy about whether or not to use this kind of weaponry? Were there debates? Were there debates about the ethics of using this kind of weapon in World War I or in World War II, or they just go full speed ahead and use them?
Yes, yeah, I think in the Civil War, there's more discussion about the ethics of landmines mm-hmm. than in World War I or World War II. And it really wasn't until the end of the Cold War in the late 1980s mm-hmm. and early 1990s when Westerners, academics, reporters, aid workers, peacekeepers went into Central America, Angola, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, Mozambique, Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and were struck by the fact that so many civilians were getting blown up despite the ink being on peace treaties, mm-hmm. sometimes for years. Mm-hmm. And what was going on was the civilians were going back home to these former war zones and stepping on these mines. Mm-hmm. And the average landmine victim takes more units of blood and more repeated surgical care than a normal munition wound. And these hospitals are very under-resourced to begin with. Mm-hmm. And so 1991, 1992 was the beginning of an international movement to ban these landmines by international law. And they were successful. They won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1997. Mm-hmm. And the International Treaty to Ban Landmines was in 1997. And I was lucky enough to be part of that movement. I was injured in 93, mm-hmm. really got out of the hospital in 94. I was asked to testify before the U.S. Senate Subcommittee for Foreign Operations, invited to the White House. And 95 and 96 started an organization called the Landmine Survivors Network to advocate for the rights and dignity of landmine victims. There are about 300,000 landmine victims. So that was a treaty in 1997. So in your question, were ethics on the use of landmines debated in World War I or World War II? And again, I've written on this. I've been doing this for 25 years. I would say, from what I know, after all these books and articles and traveling the world, there's a more of a debate about the ethics within the Confederate High Command than there was in the Axis or the European ally powers.
That's really fascinating to me. And of course, I mean, we know that both World Wars, they harnessed just massive destructive power of anything they can come up with. And these wars were absolutely horrible in scale in terms of loss of life and injuries. I just think that this is absolutely fascinating. And it's the Confederates really who have the debate over the ethics of this. Now, you mentioned your work with the international campaign to ban landmines, and I'm particularly interested in this. And we've talked about some things in the 1990s and the early 21st century. Where do we stand today? What kind of progress have we made over the years to ban the use of landmines and to get the ones that are in place removed? And I've been kind of sort of loosely following this story for a long time. I know that Lady Diana was involved very heavily in this, this has been in the news from time to time, and we keep returning to this. I'm really curious about the progress of the organization.
So in the early 1990s, when the Cold War ended, and like I said, these areas, these previously closed off areas opened up, mm-hmm. the casualty rates went sky high. By 1993, the State Department was reporting that over 26,000 people a year around the world were being maimed and killed by these weapons. Wow. And that more people have been killed by these weapons than chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons combined. Mm-hmm. When I say these weapons, I'm talking about landmines. Mm-hmm. The success story was awesome up until about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. More landmines were coming out of ground and going in. The victim rate got down to about 3,000 a year mm-hmm. through mapping, marking, demining, banning the weapon, stigmatizing the weapon. But with the rise of some insurgencies or freedom movements or non-state actors, whatever you want to call them, using landmines to control territory, the rates are starting to go up now. And this would be the use of ISIS by ISIS in Iraq and Syria, where they just lay, hey, if we can't control Georgia, we're just going to lay landmines everywhere. Mm-hmm. But that's what they're saying about Syria and Iraq. And so you have massive amounts of landmines in these areas. And also the Taliban are using landmines all over the place. And we in this community consider IEDs a landmine. Mm-hmm. If it's an explosive device that could be set off by the innocent act of a civilian and it's in the ground, it's a landmine because it's the effects of the weapon definition. Sure. Then house. And so there's a lot of manufacturing now of these artisanal landmines. So the rates are going up. And another big issue, it wasn't even a top 10 issue when I got involved, but Colombia is about the fourth in most landmine infested country in the world.
And what's going on in Colombia?
You have the FARC, have the government, you have landowners, mm-hmm. drug dealers, the protector. Uh-huh. They're all using landmines all over the country. And they're trying to train over 100,000 deminers now in Colombia as part of the peace agreement. So there has been a lot of success. 164 countries out of 193 in the world of the UN membership, as you know, mm-hmm. have banned this weapon, which is a ban on the production, a ban on the export, ban on stockpiling, and ban on use. Mm-hmm. So it's really a majority of the world. Now, on the other side of the coin, the major powers have not signed. Russia, China, India, the United States have not signed. In addition, the usual suspects haven't signed. North Korea, Iran, Libya, mm-hmm. some of those countries. Mm-hmm. But the United States, we haven't used victim-activated mines since 1991, and that's what's banned under the treaty. Mm-hmm. Just for your listeners to know that this treaty doesn't ban all landmines. It only bans victim-activated personnel mines. Mm-hmm. It does not ban command detonated mines because under international humanitarian law, command detonated mines are legal because you could be discriminate towards its target.
Right.
In addition, it doesn't ban anti-tank mines or otherwise known as anti-vehicle mines. Mm-hmm. But the anti-personnel, victim-activated or contact detonated mines were the major cause of injuries around the world. You know, as a soldier, you don't want to use your landmine to blow up a civilian. It's a waste of resources.
Right.
But the victim activated, they're out there. We can't guarantee if it's going to be, you know, at JMU. We don't know if it's going to be, that's where I am, James Madison University, mm-hmm. on the quad. We don't know if it's going to be a Domino's delivery guy. You know, maybe the students are upset that it's all online training now, so they're going to lay landmines out there to knock out some professors.
Well, let's hope not. Let's
hope not. You know, I've already hit my mind. I don't want to do it again, you know. But, you know, they don't know if it's going to be a service personnel, a mm-hmm. landscaper, a professor. Mm-hmm. They're illegal under international humanitarian law. And that was the weapon that was causing most of the devastation. And that was the weapon that caused the debates within the higher command of the Confederacy, whether they should even be using this weapon or not.
Mm-hmm. Now, are these the mines that are in use currently, the ones that are put down by, you know, states, ISIS, organizations such as ISIS and various other states that still use them, are they generally put in place in densely populated areas, or are these sort of like, you know, in battle? I don't have military experience. I know about Civil War combat, but apart from that, I don't know really much about how this goes down. And so, you know, where are they in relation to civilian populations these days?
So traditionally landmines were used just like the Civil War, defensive positions, mm-hmm. or using landmines to delay pursuing enemy forces that were pursuing you. Mm-hmm. And so they were not used in urban environments. And in most of World War I and World War II, they were not used in urban environments and otherwise as civilian areas. But now the modern day, in the last couple of years, in fact, there's a lot of landmines being used in urban areas. And that's one of the new features of landmine and UXO, unexplored ordnance clearance, is urban clearance, which is sucking up a lot of resources because it's more expensive. Mm-hmm. How do you clear out the landmines in somebody's living room? Why are they laying landmines? You know, somebody's probably asking, why would you lay landmines in urban areas? Well, the theory is, you know, it's a warp theory, but if we don't control the town, we don't want anybody else to control it either.
Right.
And we don't want these people, so they lay them in front of refrigerators, under shade trees, in a bathroom, you know, just as a disincentive for anybody to come back.
Right.
And if you're going to live here, not under our control or our thumb, we don't want you here, which is entirely new way of thinking about war. So World War One, World War Two is mostly rural, out in the field, D-Day, the deserts of North Africa, the Battle of Kursk, farm areas. But war has changed. The targets of war has changed. Yeah. It's not so much about land control, it's mind control.
Fascinating stuff. This has really been a fascinating conversation, and I've appreciated you coming on. Before I let you go, I'm curious, for those of my listeners who are interested in getting, you know, perhaps getting more involved in the campaign to ban landmines worldwide, how should they proceed? Where should they go?
You go to a great website. It's icbl.org. That's the International Campaign to Ban Landmines, which won the 1997 Nobel Peace Prize. Human Rights Watch, hrw.org, is another great organization. If you want to be a lawyer and work on human rights, that's who you should work with. In terms of the academic side and some of the work that I've done over the years, visit my Amazon author page, or just Google me at Ken Rutherford and James Madison University. The organization I co-founded, the Landmine Survivors Network, no longer exists. We had 6 overseas offices, a couple hundred employees, but our lives have changed. But you type in Landmine Survivors Network, and there's a lot of information there still on the web about victims. And you had mentioned Lady Di before, but if folks Google Princess Diana and my name, Ken Rutherford, you'll see I was one of her escorts in Bosnia.
Oh, that's cool.
And that was the last working week of her life.
Yeah.
You know, she died 23 years ago last week.
That's right.
And so that was a huge honor for us, but you could bring, we brought Princess Diana to all kinds of villages, Muslim, Croatian Catholic, Serbian Orthodox Christian. Everybody knew who she was.
Yeah.
It was almost Michael Jordan wearing a 23 Bulls jersey.
Right.
And that's where, we know she died a couple weeks later, but most Americans found out about landmines through her, through the eye of a celebrity. And she knew that with us, with me and my colleague, who is actually a professor at University of Virginia now, Jerry White. And he lost his leg in Israel. So it was the two of us with Princess Diana, but she wanted to highlight the humanitarian devastation caused by mines and use her celebrity to do that. So anyway, to find more work about the ICBL, icbl.org, hrw.org, you can Google me or just go to my Amazon author page or James Madison University and Ken Ruther.
Fantastic. We will absolutely positively do that. Ken, thanks so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it, man.
It's been an honor, man. You're awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks, man. Take it easy. So let me take a sec to tell you all about an exciting project I've got going on at Keith Harris History. I've transcribed and podcasted a series of letters written by Confederate prisoner of war Henry A. Allen. Allen was an officer in the 9th Virginia Infantry who was captured at Gettysburg at the Bloody Angle, the culmination of the Pickett-Pettigrew assault on July 3, 1863. He served in various prisoner of war camps for the duration of the war. During this time, he wrote often to his wife Sarah, back in Portsmouth, Virginia, discussing the day-to-day life in Union prisons and his many thoughts on the war, his marriage and children, and life as a prisoner.
I'm currently annotating these letters to fill in the missing information and provide links to useful resources concerning Alan in particular and the prisoner of war experience in general. This is an ongoing process where I'll be adding new information and revising my commentary as my research on the topic develops. So please go to keithharrishistory.com, click on the podcast tab, and have a listen to the Civil War Letters of Henry A. Alan. From there, you can explore all kinds of resources and book suggestions that will help enrich your understanding of Union prisons and Confederate prisoners.